And now, as part of our Sound of Cinema season, Michael Barclay's guest this week on Private Passions is the film critic Philip French.
It's quite possible that Philip French has seen more films than anyone else on the planet. Obsessed with cinema since the age of four, he's been reviewing films for The Observer for the past 50 years, as well as writing for many other papers and publishing several critically acclaimed books. On top of all of this, he's managed to squeeze in a distinguished career of more than 30 years as a BBC radio producer. You reckon, Philip, you see at least 9 films a week. Now, I think you worked out a few years ago that you'd already seen more than 14,000. That's a hell of a lot of films. How do you remember them all, or do you?
They have an interesting way of fading into each other. The older you get, the easier they fade into each other. And, of course, on the whole, the good ones manage to establish themselves, which they do immediately. Some films take a while for one to appreciate and indeed to be generally accepted. But on the whole, good films do come out, and what they do is project their own character.
And I suppose, conversely, really bad films, so stinkingly awful that you never forget the experience.
Yes, though I've never subscribed to this idea of it is so bad it's good, and never found things funny for being merely bad.
I suppose sometimes the music helps them to stick in your mind.
Oh, I think music and movies, whatever, we've been together since the silent days. We talk about silent days, it means there wasn't a soundtrack on the film itself. There was music from very large orchestras. Yes, it sticks in the mind, it becomes part of the film. And, of course, music from other sources used in films becomes to be identified with that movie. And indeed, one of my earliest memories of classical music, didn't know it was classical music, it was Stravinsky at the age of 6 or 7. I remember seeing it in Fantasia. But The Rite of Spring was, like a good deal of what Disney did, a stroke of genius. And the hair still stands on the back of my neck. Not as much hair there nowadays, but it did when I first heard it, and it continues to do so. But it was the music. It gets you, gets into your bones.
Right from this very opening, and he begins it with a bassoon where it had not normally been heard before, right up in the treble clef, top C.
It's a bit like, in my coarse mind, the opening to George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. It is a very strange sound, one of those sounds, I think, like the Gershwin, which actually takes you, almost feel you're being lifted out of your seat.
The opening of The Rite of Spring, played by the Kirov Orchestra, that's the Mariinsky Theatre Orchestra, conducted by Valery Gergiev. How conscious are you when watching a film of the music? And in some ways, is the film better when you're not too conscious of it?
I think one is probably aware of music when it's bad, when there's far too much of it. Most films nowadays do have far too much, any kind of music, and there are also very bad sound mixes now. Nevertheless, there was great music written and some superb relationships established between composers. Obviously, one thinks of Bernard Herrmann and Alfred Hitchcock.
When did you first become sort of exposed to music? Did you listen to much in your childhood?
The radio was on frequently, but...
Did you have gramophone?
We didn't have a gramophone in the house until I was 15 or 16. I was only allowed to buy one record, which was a 78, a month. I didn't own a radio set until I was 25. It was a present from my parents-in-law. At the time I was at Oxford, you had to have permission to have a radio, even if you could afford one, which I couldn't. After the war, I had a completely musicless, let's say, with no contact with live music for a whole year. I was in the army. I was an officer in the parachute regiment in Egypt. And the bit of music that I associate with that period, the only thing I ever heard live, or remember, which was the regimental band rehearsing out in the desert. The camp was out in the desert. We were surrounded by barbed wire in the desert. And they always played on regimental occasions the march arranged by our regimental bandmaster, a very fierce man called Bandmaster Rippon, which was of the Ride of the Valkyrie, called the Ride of the Valkyrie March. This bit of music stuck in my mind for years. But eventually, the Valkyrie came to become fixed on a film which I saw the world premiere of in Cannes in 1979, Francis Coppola's Apocalypse Now. One of the great sequences of modern cinema, one of the superb uses of a piece of found music in the film, which was of Colonel Kilgore and his helicopter airborne cavalry making this appalling attack on a Viet Cong village, or a village partly occupied by the Viet Cong, and turning on at full blast to ride the Valkyrie as they came in. And it was terrifying. I think it's probably the terror it induced is something that Wagner himself would have appreciated.
Certainly this sequence burns itself on the memory, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It does have then the payoff of the scene is of Colonel Kilgore, played by Robert Duvall, turning, sniffing the air and saying, he said, I love the smell of napalm in the morning, one of the great lines of cinema too.
That was the Ride of the Valkyries from Act 3 of Wagner's Die Walküre. And we heard it played by the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir George Scholte, rather appropriately, because Scholte was quite an autocratic conductor. He did wonderful things, but he didn't stand any nonsense. Well, Philip French, I don't suppose you saw many films when serving in the desert with the parachute regiment.
After that year in Egypt, I came back, went up to Oxford, and the first film I saw there was On the Waterfront. Met an old friend. We dumped our bags in the college, rushed off to see it, and we were bowled over by it. One of the things that really struck me was the score by Leonard Bernstein. It was the last, I think, or the next to last, 78 discs that I ever bought. Only sometime later that I had realised that, A, that it was the only score, original score that he'd written for a movie, and secondly, that he had turned down the invitation to write it by Kazan because he disapproved of the appearance before the House Un-American Activities Committee and naming names of Schulberg, who wrote the screenplay. Said, well, listen, will you watch a rough cut of the film? He saw the rough cut and he thought it was magnificent. And obviously, it was a tremendous invitation to him to have these extraordinary contrasts, you know, of evil and violence and exploitation, and yet coming from this love story, and the way in which he's able to make the shift from the opening of this heavy timpani and these discordant work, and then this very beautiful melody.
That was the opening of Leonard Bernstein's Symphonic Suite from On the Waterfront, performed there by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Carl Davis. It seems to me, Philip French, that over the years, composing for films has changed. That when my father's generation, Lennox Berkeley, Benjamin Britten, the leading concert composers tended to write scores, William Walton. That's shifted now, and it's become a sort of speciality for composers who don't, on the whole, tend to write concert music, although some, like that, migrates across. I mean, I think one of the reasons for that might be, having written two or three movies myself, is that you often, it's the last thing that goes on to the film, as you know. And so you'll get a copy of the film with perhaps 2 weeks to score and record the music. And they're always desperate to get hold of it, to send it out. So it becomes a kind of thing where you have to trust your first instincts rather than perhaps some profound symphonic argument and development.
It is a great pity that that so often happens. But the ideal thing is for the composer to be in right at the beginning, discussing the film itself as screenplay, the shooting script, is planned. The perfect example of this would be the relationship between Sergio Leone, the director of Spaghetti Westerns, and his regular composer, Ennio Morricone, that in the case of, I think, their finest film, Once Upon a Time in the West, the music was written, a complete score, by Morricone before the film was made. So the cast and Sergio Leone had in front of them, or sort of in their ears, the music they were scoring it to. And something like that, if that is the absolute ideal, that is something that should be generally pursued. It is a problem, of course, that a great many directors, past and present, have not a great deal of feeling for music.
And they find it very hard to describe what they want. Yes. So the closest they can get is, I'd like it to sound like this. And they never actually want it to sound precisely like that. So it's quite a problem. I mean, of course, the other thing that we've already mentioned with the Wagner is the use of existing well-known pieces. One thinks of Death in Venice, for example, or indeed our next film.
One way in which music can change in one's life is the images to which it is attached. I have a particular feeling for Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony, one of the first countries abroad in which I spent any time. I had 3 weeks on my own travelling through Italy as an undergraduate. And hearing the Mendelssohn, it seemed to fit the various moods that I experienced. Something sort of sparky, lyrical, uplifting, and something rather heavy, Catholic, slightly oppressive, which you get in the two major movements of it. And, of course, it meant Italy to me until in 1979... Peter Yates, the director, made a film called Breaking Away, which was about life in a small town in the Middle West of America, Bloomington, Indiana. There's a young boy who's trying to find himself an identity apart from his very conventional parents, and he invents an Italian persona for him. He loves cycling, and he loves Italian music, and he pretends to speak Italian. He's liberated both by his experience and by cycling, and there's a wonderful sequence in it in which he has a race across the country of some miles with a Cinzano van lorry. And he plays the first movement for the Italian Symphony. And it is a wonderfully exhilarating sequence. It suddenly meant a great deal to me because just 20 years before the film had come out, I had been a graduate student at Indiana University in this very town, and I met my wife there, and we were married there. And so suddenly, the Mendelssohn became transferred to this small, flat, prosaic, Middle Western town, but captured, as it were, the lyrical and the sonorous aspects that the town had for me. And the film ends with a rather sad couple making their way up the stairs to get married in the local county courthouse, where indeed I got married myself.
Actually, I also think it's one of the great openings in music, this. Ba-dum, bum, ba-dum.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. The first movement from Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony, played by the Boston Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Charles Munch. Your next piece of music, Philip French, is all about the emotion provoked by music, the creation of a mood. And I think it marks a shift in your own musical tastes.
I started to develop a particular interest in modern jazz. The first really important, or probably the first, Nouvelle Vague film from France, The Lift of the Scaffold of Louis Malle. And for this thriller, a very cool thriller, which is Malle saw as a sort of cross between Hitchcock and Robert Bresson, he thought it would be a great idea to have a score by Miles Davis, who happened to be, as he was cutting the film, making a visit to Paris. He managed to get an introduction to Davis. Davis said he couldn't really do it, but he didn't have his own group with him. He was working with French musicians. But Malle, a very persuasive man and a man of great charm, coaxed Davis into a studio on the one night he had free, and they were in the studio from 10 o'clock at night until 5 o'clock in the morning, and they had the whole score for the film. So there's only about, really, about 18 or 19 minutes of music there, but it gave the film its particular tone. It created what was then a considerable vogue for the use of jazz music in movies, also for the idea of using jazz as a counterpoint to the action rather than some Mickey Mouse-type commentary upon it. Particularly admirable, I think, is the opening part, which I'm not sure whether it was suggested to him by Malle, called Générique, that it had the idea of noir in the music itself.
And I think they improvised.
The whole thing was improvised with Malle sitting there working on it, which is why there were 7 or 8 hours. But that was it. Miles did no further work on it. This music sort of brought you into this new world that Malle had sensed around him in Paris.
I quite like this idea of improvising to the image because you get such a spontaneous reaction to what you're seeing. Générique from the soundtrack to Louis Malle's film Ascenseur pour l'échafaud, Lift to the Scaffold, and we heard Miles Davis there playing his composition, well, his improvised composition with Barney Willen, tenor sax, René Utrega, piano, Pierre Michelot bass, and Kenny Clark drums. And if you want to find details of that disc, go to the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website, and all the music is listed there. Philip, as we said, you've been reviewing films for more than 50 years. I wonder if you ever worry about making enemies, because you're very honest always.
I've made a few enemies, yes. I've only been sued once, unsuccessfully, as it turned out. I won't say who it was. People who have been critics are much more sensitive than those who haven't, I think. John Schlesinger, Lindsay Anderson and Carol Rice, all three, with whom I'd been on relatively friendly terms. They'd all been film writers involved in criticism. And sensitive is probably the wrong word in this context. I think touchy and thin-skinned are the right words. I never deliberately caught...
It occurs to me, I know some writers now who won't review books unless they like them, but you can't do that, because if you said you liked everything, nobody would trust your judgment.
I'm much more interested now, the older I've got, really. What I enjoy writing is sort of exegesis rather than analysis, rather than evaluation. The first thing you do, you make a snap judge at the beginning, something you've seen or you've read, yes, this is worth treatment. But the other treatment is more analysis, I think, rather, and an interpretation, rather than just say, well, this part is stronger than some other part, or there were problems with the structure and things like that. That interests me less and less now.
Well, you've always been interested in innovative filmmaking, and that has led you to all kinds of music. We heard the Miles Davis and the Louis Malle collaboration, and now we're going to hear music by Harry Partch.
Mm. One of my favourite directors, Nick Rogue, in his 1979 film Bad Timing, used some Partch music in this. This very strange, eerie music. He invented many instruments which his music should be interpreted. And I don't really know what to make of it. I don't actually technically understand it. I've looked up several of the words that he used to describe it in musical dictionaries, but they never remain in my head.
Funny world that creates, doesn't it? Yeah. It's as though somebody is just saying, well, I'm going to do my own thing and be damned. And it's about, like, there were people like Cornelius Cardew here in the Scratch Orchestra. There's an element of that kind of, and there's something quite, it may not be the most profound thought, but there's something quite refreshing about it being very sort of candid and upfront. Ulysses at the Edge, composed and conducted by Harry Parch, who also performed with the Gate Five Ensemble. You have a Swedish wife, Kirsty, who's a translator, and I wonder whether that has led you to Scandinavian music, Philip French.
Well, she led me to Scandinavia in the first place, and then took me every year since then. I've been there for the last 56 years, every summer. I've come to love Scandinavian music. It's Grieg and Peer Gynt that has somehow stuck in my mind, the Hall of the Mountain King, because it is the theme whistled by Peter Lorre as the serial killer in Fritz Lang's first sound movie, M. And that is a film full of astonishing images. I think Lang is probably the greatest single filmmaker in the history of the movies. Why he actually chose that, I don't know, but it has a very eerie sound.
In the Hall of the Mountain King from Grieg's Peer Gynt Suite, Opus 46, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan. Philip French, you decided to step down as the film critic of The Observer after, as I said at the beginning, 50 years in the post. How do you feel about the prospect of retirement? Lots of time, because lots of people, of course, when they retire, go to the cinema more often.
Well, the best known of my predecessors at The Observer, C.A. Lejeune, who was there and saw the coming of sound. She was there from 1927 until 1960, when she left out of disgust at Hitchcock's Psycho and the simultaneous appearance of a film that she equally loathed, which is Michael Powell's Peeping Tom. She never went to the cinema again. She hung up her boots and, you know, never went on the field, and no one ever saw her.
But you'll probably just be more selective.
Well, I think I'll be more selective. I'm going to do some more general writing. I'm putting together a collection of my writings. This one will be just on reviews over the last 50 years.
Have your musical tastes changed, would you say, as you've got older?
In many ways, yes, and I hope that I will have more time, find myself more time, to listen to music. I mean, to listen to it properly rather than in this is a somewhat casual or desultory way in which I have just picking up things here and there. I have suddenly developed This is a belated interest in Beethoven's late string quartets. And this has come partly about by seeing one of the best films that I've ever seen about the musical life, what it is to be a musician, to have that kind of dedication, to have something so fulfilling. It was a rather beautiful film called A Late Quartet by Yaron Zilberman. He's a documentarist, his first feature film. He's got together a wonderful cast. It's about four characters and the effect on the group and their future by the decision of the cellist, great performance by Christopher Walken, to retire. He is developing degenerative disease. And it is how they face up to this future. But it gave me an understanding that I had never really had before, an emotional understanding of what it is to work together as a musical group. And I suppose what it says will be very familiar to you and to musicians. But it seemed to me to have both a truth in itself about what they were doing, but also a truth, a heightened truth about our own experience of aging and how the world changes around you as you age. And then suddenly that you have to, in a sense, move on, that everything comes to an end, whether it be a piece of music, whether it's a life, whether it is a group of associations.
Well, we can reverse roles here just for a moment, because I actually went and saw that film for Front Row and reviewed it. And I agree with you. I thought it was wonderful. And I thought the music side of it was exceptionally well handled. I completely believed these people were playing. If I was to be Philip French at his most strict, I would say there are one or two rather melodramatic moments. But that apart, I enjoyed it enormously.
But as I have read a great many podibiographies of the lives of musicians, God, there's a lot of melodrama in the lives of musicians, isn't there?
Touché.
It is.
So let's hear a Beethoven string quartet. Is it the one you heard in the film?
Yes, one that I particularly like. I'm very pleased to hear that my own, as it were, intuitions of the truth are confirmed by your experience of them.
Music from the Adagio of Beethoven's String Quartet No. 14 in C-sharp minor, Opus 131, performed there by the Juilliard String Quartet. So as you retire from a lifelong association, at least a professional association with the film industry, Philip, I wonder what sort of state you feel you're leaving it in. Is it good, and particularly in this country?
A lot of interesting work being done in this country. Unfortunately, though understandably, if someone has a success in this country, and they make films that are near to the mainstream, they're immediately whisked off to Hollywood. But we have people like Mike Leigh, who have been able to pursue a career here. It is much less than Ken Loach, but it is much more difficult now to create a body of work than it was 50 or 60 years ago.
Let's play out on something which I think has been a favourite for some time.
Yes, one of my great passions has always been American popular music of the 1920s and 30s. Ruth Etting has always been one of my favourites. I listen to her a great deal, and she cheers me up a lot. There was a film made about Ruth Etting some years ago with Doris Day, who I also greatly admire. And it was a very tough film about her life and this tragic marriage. And
but wasn't she the wife of a gangster?
She was married to a gangster and gambler called the Gimp Snyder. And strikingly impersonated, uningratiatingly, by Jimmy Cagney in the Doris Day film Love Me or Leave Me. One striking aspect of Ruth Etting is the way that she was working with great jazz musicians. She was like not just a singer, but an instrument working with the others. There's one particular recording I like, which is by the team of Henderson, Brown and De Silva. On this particular record, Button Up Your Overcoat, there is Tommy Dorsey on trumpet rather than his usual trombone. His brother, Jimmy, on clarinet, and the two great string performers with on jazz records, Joe Venuti, the violinist, and Eddie Lang on guitar.
Well, Philip French, as you button up your observer overcoat, let's allow Ruth Etting to play you out with Button Up Your Overcoat.
Ruth Etting's recording of Button Up Your Overcoat, with music by Ray Henderson and lyrics by B.G. De Silva and Lou Brown, ending this week's Private Passions. The programme was presented by Michael Barclay and produced by Jane Greenwood. It's a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. And you can download that programme if you go to the Private Passions page on the Radio 3 website. Next week, there'll be another chance to hear Michael speaking to the film director, Mike Lee.